Have you ever felt frustrated because you just couldn't find a lovely book to read? I can start to crave not just a good book, but a book that draws me in and evokes such a deep emotion that I can say, wow, that was a lovely book. Welcome, friends. This is Emmy B on Lovely Books Podcast, where it's my job to highlight the lovely books that keep you reading and connect you to the world. If you're new to Lovely Books, this podcast is more than just a best books podcast. It's about the reader's experience and takeaway. No book reviews, no analysis of literary content, just thoughts and personal anecdotes brought to our minds by the characters and subject matter that we love. That's what brings the book to life for you. I hope we give you something to think about, something to laugh about, and something lovely to read. Welcome, listeners. In this episode, I am so excited to be speaking with Alka Joshi. Her most recent release was published on June 22nd, 2021, entitled The Secret Keeper of Jaipur, the second book in the Jaipur trilogy. Alka, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me. I am excited, Emily, to be here.
It's such a pleasure to chat with you. I just want to give you a little bit of background on Alka and where she's from. She was born in Jodhpur, Rajasthan, India, but she's lived in the United States since the age of 9. Alka has a BA from Stanford University and an MFA from California College of the Arts. She ran her own advertising and PR agency for 30 years. The Henna Artist was her first novel. Currently, she's working on the third book of the trilogy and a screen adaptation of The Henna Artist. That's exciting.
Well, I'm working on the third book of the trilogy, but I'm not necessarily working on that screen adaptation. That's up to the professionals. They're doing that kind of thing. I get to be on the TV series like a little fly on the wall.
Oh, I love that.
I just get to listen in on, you know, how they're developing the episodes and maybe have a chance to say, well, you know, I have a little idea about that.
Perfect. That's exciting. That's really great. Before we get started, I do always like to ask authors, because they do have a presence usually on a web page and on their pages with their publishers, I do like to ask you to share a little known fact.
Well, a little known fact about me is that I write from bed. I prefer to do everything in my bed. I prefer to write. I prefer to snack. I prefer to pet my dogs. I prefer to do everything in my bed. I am not in my bed currently, right. But my bed is my creative place.
And that is a fun fact. I love that, and I read this on one of your, I think I read this either on an interview or one of your websites, but you have been in advertising for the majority of your adult career.
You bet. Yeah. Advertising and marketing. I didn't even know when I started what marketing was. and then, you know, I quickly found out. And, you know, I didn't realize that for years and years, what I'd really been doing was building these little stories for 1 minute commercials, 30 second commercials, you know, radio spots. And what I was really doing was learning how to tell a story very quickly.
Yeah.
So when it came time to write long form fiction, you know, my husband said, all you have to do is just expand those stories into something a lot larger. And I know you can do this. And I kept saying, no, you know, I'm a hack. Like, I think of people in advertising, you know, most of us who are writers, we're kind of like, we're taking shortcuts, you know, we're taking a lot of shortcuts. And so Brad said, no, I think that you can do this. I think that you'd be really good at writing fiction. So it's only because of him that I even became a writer.
So with the process of you actually taking a story then, were you able to start? I don't know much about advertising. So does the story come from the middle, or does it come from a beginning or from an end?
You mean like when I'm doing a commercial, that kind of thing?
Yeah. And how does that translate into actually writing a novel? Did that kind of develop the same way? Is there a connection there?
Well, that's a really good question. I've never had that before. Now, what I think is that every scene, whether you're doing it in advertising or whether you're doing it in long form fiction, every scene, you need to enter into the middle of it. You do not enter from the very beginning and you do not leave at the very end. You need to cut into that scene right smack dab in the middle where the most prescient part of it is. So that's what we try to do in advertising. And also in advertising, sometimes you need to bookend the beginning and the end of a commercial just so we can place people where we are and, you know, what we're doing. So of course, at the end, there's always the, you know, this is how you buy this product or service. And at the beginning, there's always this, a little bit of, you know, are we in a park? Are we in a house? Are we playing with kids? You know, what are we doing? So the henna artist came about, you know, very, it's so interesting how I never thought I'd be writing about India. For so many years, I hadn't been to India. And, but it was always, you know, it's just part of my DNA. It's just, I eat Indian food. I'm around my parents, you know, they're speaking in Hindi. And so I've been around that culture forever. But I thought that when I started writing, I might do something more contemporary or more Western. But really what I wanted to write about was sort of a reimagining of my mother's life. And how that came about is because right around the time that I entered this program to learn how to write novels, I was also going to Jaipur all the time with my mother. And so my younger brother had bought this condo. And so mom said, you know, take me there, because she was in her 70s. She wanted to have a chaperone. She said, take me there, leave me here until you finish your semester and then come back and get me. And so that's what she and I did. And sometimes it would be my younger brother who came to get her. And sometimes it would be me. But we made this trip like four or five, six times, you know, during my program and a little bit after. And so I was talking to mom a lot and I was thinking, you know, mom is just a remarkable person in the sense that she had this very conventional life. You know, she always did what her parents told her to do, including leaving college to get married to somebody that they had arranged. But she raised me to be so different, you know, like she could have had a little mini me with me, right? So she could have raised me exactly the same, but she decided that with me, she wanted me to have a very independent life where I would make all my own decisions. And I just thought, you know, thank you, mom. Thank you for giving me that kind of independent life. How can I thank her back? And I just thought, well, maybe what I can do is create this fictional character who gets to desert her marriage, which I don't know, maybe my mom did want to do that at some point. I don't know. But I can invent this character who deserts her marriage before children are born. And then she goes on and becomes something like a celebrated henna artist and herbalist. And she, you know, she has her own business. She is making her own house. She has her own sort of secrets that she's keeping. And she also becomes a confidant to a lot of these ladies she's servicing. And so that is, I said, mom, here you are. You are Lakshmi in my novel.
Well, and I love that. And I think she's a character that every reader could really connect to on different levels. She had a lot of depth to her. And I mean, she was a passionate woman. She was a strong woman, but she was patient and she was a good friend. She also was able to sort of bring out this tale of the way that women can lift each other and help strengthen each other, but they also have a lot of power to tear each other down.
Yeah. And I think, you know, part of this, I'm really borrowing from what my mother taught me, which is that every woman deserves to make the decisions in her life that are going to determine her destiny. Yeah. You know, all of us women should be able to, no matter what culture we are from, able to do that. And so what I wanted to explore also is what happened to my mother when she did not get to make the decisions that she always allowed me to make? Mm-hmm. Well, you know what? My mother, sometimes I found her depressed. Sometimes I think she was really angry. I think that there were times when she really just wanted to leave everything behind and start her own life. I do think that what happens when women do not get the agency they deserve is they take it out on the environment that they're in. They take it out maybe on other women around them, or they take it out on themselves.
Yeah, definitely. And I think part of the success of this book is that that was really powerfully told in Lakshmi's ability and what she gained with her independence and her ability to make her own choices and what she lost when all of that started crumbling around her.
Yeah. Yeah. And she's not a perfect person, right? No. Emily? I mean, you know, I think that's what everybody kind of resonates with is mm-hmm. she's not some Disney princess, you know, mm-hmm. She has got, humiliation to deal with. She's got shame to deal with. She has her own anger, which she tries to curb against some of these ladies who are trying to put her down. She has ambition. She has nurturing abilities, even though she's choosing to be child free. She has nurturing abilities, and she has that ability to be that way with her ladies whom she services. And then also, you know, with Malik and with Radha, her sister.
You know, one of the things that was really interesting to me that in American culture, we don't really have a super strong sense of is the caste system that is still prevalent in India today. And you touch on that quite a bit in your book. Now, writing this book in America, did you intend to write this for the Western reader? I don't know. Is this translated?
I did not intend to write this for any particular reader. Okay. I wrote a book that, first of all, could give my mother this freedom in the 1950s mm-hmm. In the character of Lakshmi. Secondly, I wrote a book that I would like to read.
Yeah.
I had never seen a book like this before, mm-hmm. especially taking place in the 1950s in Rajasthan, where there's all this building going on. There's all this excitement about having the country free again and, you know, the British go home. We don't need you anymore. Thank you so much. Yeah. And so, you know, there's this exuberance and I wanted to capture that I didn't know anything about until I started researching and talking to my parents about, you know, what was going on in the country at that time. So I wrote the book I wanted to read. And I am a product of both the East and the West.
Yeah.
So when I am in either country, or even when I'm in Europe, or if I'm in South America, or wherever it is I happen to be, I can, you know, divorce myself from my Americanness, and I can sort of see what that country is like. Yeah. And I can sort of see what their perception of Americans are, and then what my perception of their country is based on my Eastern and Western, product, you know, my personality. Yeah. So, you know, when I'm in India, I can separate myself from Indians. I can identify with them, but I can also mm-hmm. separate myself from them. And when I am in America, I can identify with Americans and I can separate myself from them.
Yeah.
So I wrote a book that hopefully covers the good and the bad that takes place in India. And I wanted to weave it very organically into the story. Mm-hmm. So it didn't feel like I was giving people a history lesson or I'm giving right. them a lecture or anything like that. But I wrote about the caste system as these characters are experiencing it, because that's kind of how life is lived in India.
Yeah.
They're, you know, everybody knows kind of what caste you are based on maybe the job that you're doing. And mm-hmm. also based on your family, you know, a lot of people don't tend to move around from city to city. So, you know, everybody knows your family was Brahmin. So you're probably Brahmin. Mm-hmm. Your family was, you know, in the business caste. So you're in the business caste. A lot of times they can tell by the last name what caste you're in. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there is kind of this official caste ladder. But, you know, I would also argue, Emily, that almost every country has a caste system. They just don't call it a caste system. Because if you look at, you know, maybe Isabel Wilkerson's book that she wrote last year about caste, it's mm-hmm. just called caste. Mm-hmm. Essentially, what she's saying is that here in the United States, we also have a caste system. It's driven by color. And right. so, you know, our gardeners and our, you know, household staff and those kinds of people tend to be of a darker color. And, you know, the CEOs of companies and, you know, in the white collar jobs will tend to be largely white. Mm-hmm. So we have also, just like I think in every country, there are class systems and caste systems. We just don't call it that.
Right. And I do, I actually find that interesting because I did see in some of my research that the caste system was officially banned in 1950, which is when this book is set in. And, you know, and when I look at that comparatively to what was happening in the United States in terms of segregation in the 1950s, you're right. It does have a lot of really interesting parallels. But I loved how in this book you used the familiarity that most Americans have with the Indian culture being henna, which is something that we have seen, which I was actually talking to someone about this because I am upset. I'm a little obsessed. Your book took me a little bit over the edge with the henna. Because I grew up here in Salt Lake City, Utah, but I used to vacation a ton in California, which is where you are. And I remember one of my favorite things to do in California was to go to the beach, do henna tattoos on our body when we were on vacation in California. It was like the cool thing to do. And so I think the food and the clothing and the henna was a really easy visual for readers in terms of familiarity. And it kind of helped us get drawn into the things that we didn't understand and paint a very whole picture of the setting for the henna artist.
You know, what's interesting to me is how differently the readers in the West perceive the book and how differently they perceive it in the East. First of all, the commonality is that everybody can relate to these characters. These characters are, you know, interesting. They're deep. They have lots of layers. And so everybody around the world can relate to these characters. But in the West, people find the Eastern tradition, the South Asian traditions, and then the dress and, you know, the henna and things that you're saying, very, you know, fascinating. Now, my South Asian readers tell me that what they find fascinating is all the history that I have put in the books. Because a lot of times after the British left, there was not a clear idea about how to write about the history while the Brits were there. And so a lot of that history has been left out of Indian history books. And a lot of young people, you know, who were raised in the 50s, 60s, and then now the next generation that's maybe being raised in the West or somewhere else in the global diaspora, they have no idea about what was happening in India after the British left. And so they're like, wow, thanks. You know, like the big piece of history that's missing. And now you brought it forward in this book. And then the other thing that they always say is that this book makes us proud of our heritage because you pointed out all the joy and the beauty. Whereas mostly from the Western perspective, we hear about the poverty and the illiteracy, you know? So I tried to bring all of it in these books, everything that's good about the South Asia and then the things that I don't like about South Asia. And I've tried to incorporate all of that in here. And so that balanced perspective is what I think everybody's kind of resonating with.
Yeah, definitely. And another thing too, is just the hope that your characters always maintained, that despite the, as you mentioned, the poverty and the difficulties and all the things that they had to overcome, they did continue to have this hope that education and ability and experience would propel them to a better, more stable life.
Yeah.
I think worldwide, that's something that we all hope for.
Yeah. Yeah. But also, I think the other thing that I'm trying to show with this book, and I think this is another reason why, you know, a lot of people can resonate with this, is that I'm saying, look, India has their poverty, but they also have a huge middle class and they also have a very wealthy class. So don't forget that just like every other country, we also have these different socioeconomic classes that I think, you know, you just need to recognize. India is not just one stereotype of people. It is a lot of different kinds of people with different abilities and resources at their fingertips.
I love that. I so love that. Well, let's dive into a summary of The Secret Keeper of Jaipur. I love this one. This was so fun for me to read. I'm just going to read the summary as it is shown online. At the age of 20, Malik is a well-spoken young man with the benefit of a boarding school education, courtesy of Samir Singh. He has become involved with a young tribal woman in Shimla. Wanting Malik to have a solid career, Lakshmi arranges an apprenticeship at the Jaipur Palace for him, which does not make his beloved very happy. Malik soon finds that not much has changed in the Pink City. Power and money still move seamlessly among the wealthy class, and favors flow from Jaipur's royalty, but only if certain secrets remain buried. When the Royal Cinema's balcony tragically collapses on opening night, Malik sets out to uncover why it happened. In the end, he has to enlist Lakshmi's help to untangle the web of lies that Jaipur's elite would prefer to hide. So I love the continuation of both Malik and Lakshmi as secret keepers.
Because you know what's really interesting? Emily, I thought the whole time I was writing this that Malik was the secret keeper. I mean, that's what I had in my head. But I had this book club recently, and all of these people reading it, they said, oh my gosh, he's not the only secret keeper. Lakshmi is also a secret keeper. Mm-hmm. And you know, the Maharanis keep their secrets, and the Singhs keep their secrets. And then there's that jeweler, Motilal. He keeps all of these family secrets too. So I didn't realize there's actually a lot of secret keepers in
Jen. Yeah. Yeah. Which was really, really cool. So how did the idea though of, let's just talk about, Malik, Malik?
Yeah, it's perfect.
Okay, Malik, let's talk just about him. So how did the idea of that secret keeper sort of evolve from one story to the next?
So, you know, the way that these things come to me is scenes. And the first scene that I saw when the character of Malik kept telling me, you know, please write my story, write my story. The first scene that I saw come to my brain was Nimmi at the Shimla Mall. And that's a large pedestrian mall. It's a place where my family used to escape for the hot summers. Also, that's why I know Shimla pretty well, up at the foothills of the Himalayas. You know, this pedestrian mall is lined with all kinds of historical buildings. And so a lot of people walk from one building to the next. And then, of course, because it attracts all these tourists and honeymooners, there are all these vendors set up all around the mall. Nimmi is one of those vendors. I see that she is this tribal woman because she's dressed so differently. Yes. You know, her headgear, her jewelry, everything is different. And then I realize that she is putting out her flora that she collects way up in the higher reaches of the mountains. And she's, you know, kind of setting it all out for tourists or restaurants or whoever wants to buy them. And then I notice that on her, at her feet, there's this basket, a woven basket with her two small children in it who are tethered to the basket. And then I see these two people coming toward her. One of them is Malik. And I thought, oh, look, he's 20 years old. Like, I didn't know he was going to be 20, but all of a sudden I know that he is older than 18 and younger than 30. And he's somewhere, you know, he looks like he's about 20. And he's, you know, he's still kind of thin and gangly, but he's dressed so much differently from the street child that he used to be in The Henna Artist. And then next to him is Lakshmi. And she is kind of dressed for more like spring or fall weather. So I have to decide, is it spring or is it fall? I'm not quite sure. And she is about 40 something. And as they come closer to Nimmi's stall, they are looking at all of the flora. And, you know, Lakshmi is very interested in what this woman is collecting way up in the north and what kind of herbal remedies she might have, because she is a nomad. You can tell by her dress. Anybody who lives up there would know a nomad because they dress so differently. And she could tell that this woman has, you know, some interesting ideas about what might make some interesting, you know, herbal concoctions. So she's very interested in the flora. But then she turns around and she notices Malik and Nimmi have some kind of a connection. And she's like, is this the first time they've met? Have they met before? What's going on? And then she is all of a sudden thinking, all right, listen, this woman is a widow with two children. And so if Malik gets involved with her, he will have this ready-made family at too young of an age. Yeah. And you know, Lakshmi is all about education. So she wants Malik to be on his own two feet now that he has this beautiful boarding school education. Mm-hmm. So she says, look, I'm going to arrange this apprenticeship for you. And he goes down to do that. So that's kind of how the first scene came to me. It didn't become the first scene of the book because, you know, as I write, things evolve. But it became a very central scene in my mind about the three characters I was going to write from. Each of them has a perspective in The Henna Artist.
And I love the multi-perspective that you used in this book to kind of show the differences. One thing, and I love how you describe that. That's such a beautiful visual. For people who have read the book, I can see that moment as you describe it. But an interesting thing is you describe that. And I think about Lakshmi as, you know, with her henna and with her herb garden at the hospital, she is a healer. Mm-hmm. She heals hearts. She heals wounds. Mm-hmm. And they say that when you fall in love, you'll either marry your mother or the opposite of your mother. And so as you're creating this visual for me, I'm really seeing Lakshmi and Nimmi really as you know, these mirror images of each other.
Absolutely right. Oh my God, Emily, you got it. Yay. Because, you know, I would think that Malik has had such a great role model in Lakshmi, a strong woman, yes, who also allows herself to be vulnerable, but she's mm-hmm. a strong woman and she takes her own counsel. And so why would he not be attracted to another woman who is like that? Because he realizes all of the, you know, strengths that Lakshmi has. And he's like, you know, I would want to be with a strong woman. He's not afraid of strong women. Yeah. And so I love that about him. And yes, Nimmi is the opposite, a mirror image of Lakshmi, but younger and illiterate. But, you know, her illiteracy does not make her think that she is less than anybody else.
No.
It's just a factor of her being a nomad, not having a school that she's always been in for the entire year. And so I like the fact that she goes up against Lakshmi almost to say, okay, bring it on. Go ahead and bring it on because I got you.
a little head to head. I like that. And also, as you're looking at characters who run parallel to each other, you have who I would say is Malik's antithesis, who is Ravi.
Yes.
In my mind, I picture them very close to the same age.
Yes.
So you have someone who has been educated and spoon-fed and had the silver spoon in his mouth, who behaves very badly throughout the book. And then you have Malik, who he has the education, but he has a wisdom that Ravi will never have.
Right.
Because he's seen both sides of the coin. And so as you compare their choices, their loyalties, where their loyalties lie and who they lie with, what their integrity is and their level of integrity is with each other and what just purely their choices are. Mm-hmm. Because with Malik's education, he really has a much broader choice of who he could marry and what he could do with his life. But his wisdom in everything that he's experienced in poverty, it makes that less appealing to him. And I loved that.
Yeah. One of the things that I find attractive about people, just people that I want to, you know, be with or whatever. One of the things I find really attractive about people is if they take responsibility for their actions. Mm-hmm. This is really important to me. And, you know, it was important for me when I picked a partner in my life, my husband of 26 years, that that he acknowledged when he did something right, when he did something wrong, and that he would take responsibility for either of those things that were going on. So for me, Malik is somebody who takes responsibility for everything that he does. He takes responsibility for people, for their well-being, but he also takes responsibility when he does something that isn't kosher. Yeah. And, you know, we can see when he runs up against Sheila Singh, nay Sheila Sharma, we see that responsibility sort of show up. Ravi is somebody who has never taken responsibility and he's never been forced to take responsibility, as we learned in The Henna Artist. He was never held accountable for what happened to Radha in The Henna Artist. And so he's grown up into a man who does not take that kind of responsibility and has a very weak moral compass. And in a way, I think what I'm trying to say is something my father always said, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. And so Samir is just like Ravi. You know, Ravi has turned into another Samir, not taking responsibility for, you know, the sort of moral attachment to his wife. And meanwhile, Malik is very much patterned after Lakshmi. He takes responsibility for things. He is interested in other people's welfare, and he will admit when he has done something wrong. I think the apple does not fall far from the tree. My dad was so right about that.
He was so right about that. There is so much deception in this book. It seems everyone in these upper classes, these more elite classes, everyone has a secret and everyone is keeping something from someone to maintain the status quo. Yeah. And that deception really drove more deception and more deception through the entirety of the book. What do you see as sort of the anchor that breeds that deception?
I think that corruption is so insidious that once it has sort of seeped into the mainstream, it's very hard to get rid of it because there are so many people who are complicit in making sure that that corruption succeeds. And part of what happens, I think, in every country, and this really, you know, it's not just about India. This happens in the United States, in England, and, you know, France, everywhere, is that people at the higher levels are not held accountable for what happens generally. You know, for the mistakes they make, they can always hire the best lawyers, they can always throw money at a problem, and they don't have to be held accountable. The people who end up taking the responsibility for a lot of the damage that's done are the poor, the scapegoats of a, you know, we see this all the time with these poor women who bring forward sexual harassment suits. And they're not doing it lightly. You know, they know that their lives are going to be upended. Yeah. But then in the end, you know, somebody else, the person who caused them that pain usually gets away with it. And they just have better legal counsel. They have money to throw at everything. And so, you know, they the people who are victims generally stay victims. I just, you know, I think maybe that's the comment that I'm trying to make in The Henna Artist and in also The Secret Keeper of Jaipur. You know, in The Henna Artist, we also have, you know, Parvati. Why does Parvati get to win at the end? Why? It makes no sense. But, you know, that's the reality of life. And why does Ravi get to win here at the end? Why does Samir get to win at the end? They actually do have a little bit of a comeuppance. But as you saw in the end, you know what? They're going to land on their feet.
Yeah, they're going to be fine. So The Henna Artist did leave me brokenhearted. And I'm sorry, but I am so glad that I didn't find this book until the second one came out because I don't think I could have waited. I'm glad I got to read these almost back to back because I was really brokenhearted at the end of The Henna Artist, but I did feel like there was so much hope, especially for Malik at the end of The Secret Keeper. So where will the next book take us? Can we have a little bit of insight on how that's going to go?
Oh, I'm so excited. I am having so much fun writing book number three. So if The Secret Keeper focused more on Malik and less on Radha, then book number three will focus on Radha. So so The Henna Artist is 1955. The Secret Keeper of Jaipur is 1969. Book number three is 1973.
Okay.
And Radha is living in Paris. Because while she was in school in Shimla, she met a Frenchman who was traveling with a student visa across the Himalayas. They started talking and they ended up eloping and then got married in France. And now she has two little girls and she's really happy with her life. She has that family she wanted. But she also has something else she hadn't anticipated, and that is ambition. And so she got a chemistry degree at the Sorbonne and she started you know, in a fragrance lab as a chemist. And she has worked her way up to working for a master perfumer. She's on the cusp of helping her master perfumer design a signature scent for a client. And there's a knock at her door and somebody she hasn't seen for 18 years in The Henna Artist is on the other side of that door. And he wants to know who his birth mother is.
Oh, I love that. That's so exciting. And do you have a release date for that yet?
Only the year 2023.
Okay. 2023.
Right. I'm supposed to deliver the manuscript, I think spring next year. And, I, you know, I'm pretty well on track for that. And, I just think it's going to be, first of all, it's going to be gorgeous because we're going to see Paris, a lot of Paris.
Great.
And who doesn't like Paris?
I mean,
I originally wanted to set it in Paris, partly because I wanted to go to Paris and write and just, you know, write off my whole trip.
Totally.
But with the pandemic, I couldn't do that. So I haven't not been able to go, but I've lived there before. So I'm just drawing on my memory and everything that I see on the internet. But, You know, it's partly in Paris, it's partly in Jaipur, and it's partly in this place called Uttar Pradesh, which is a state next to Rajasthan, where they actually make a lot of these base notes that are put in perfumes all around the world. And India, you know, produces a lot of fragrances that people don't realize. They're mainly the base oils that go inside the fragrance that you're buying. So every fragrance has a top note, a middle note, and a base note. And so Indian oils are often the base note.
So I have to ask, did you know this? Did the story develop that way? And then you discovered this fun fact about perfuming? Or is this something that is like common knowledge to someone if you lived in that region?
I know nothing about perfuming. So I'm learning.
That's so cool.
I know. And I'm doing all this research, and I went to New York about a month ago, and I met with master perfumers, and I visited a fragrance lab just to find out, you know, what does it smell like? What does it feel like? What, you know, like how does everyone dress? Are they all in lab coats? You know, what's going on? And I hope to be able to do that also before I finish the book. I want to be able to do that also in Paris so that I can really get a feel for that. But I didn't know anything about fragrances. But once again, the scene that came to me is that Radha is in this this lab. That's the way that the scene came to me. Yeah. I thought, what is she doing in a lab? And then I realized that these people are making perfume. They have tiny little vials of you know, fragrances, ingredients that they're going to put into all of these perfumes. Mm-hmm. And then I thought, oh, she's making perfume. And then she gets a call. So this is, I mean, it's so weird how these scenes come to me. They're like movies.
I love it.
She gets a call and I realize it's her husband asking where she is because they need to pick up one of their daughters, you know, from school. And as you know, in Paris, you know, the parents usually walk the kids to school and then walk them back home or take them on the metro or something. And so, you know, he's like, where are you? You know, our daughter needs you. And she's like, well, I can't leave. I can't leave right now. I, you know, have a meeting coming up. I have to finish this project and so on. So they're having some tension. And, you know, so I thought, oh, wow. So Radha has ambition. I didn't even know. I thought she just wanted to be, you know, a wife and mother, but no, she has other things she wants to do.
So she's getting it a little from her big sister, maybe.
Well, yeah. And then we're going to see her relationship with Lakshmi has evolved. You know, she was so obstreperous before. She was much like, don't tell me what to do. Mm-hmm. I got, you know, I came over here to find you in Jaipur, 1,000 miles away. And now you're trying to tell me what to do. No, I'm not listening to you. And so now that she's 30 years old, she's kind of cooled down a little bit, but she still has that sort of fieriness in her that Lakshmi does not have. She has this fire in her, this sort of need to even create complicated situations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love that. That sounds really exciting. So, in talking with you about the research that you do, is that what's the funnest part of the writing for you? Is it getting the ideas actually out and onto paper? It sounds like when you research and when you're learning things and discovering things, that is a very enjoyable part of the writing process to you.
Totally enjoyable. I love research. Research will take you down into all these rabbit holes. And then during those rabbit holes, you figure this little kernel of a fact and you go, oh, I could use that. I could totally use that. Or let's say I'm watching an old documentary from that time period in Paris, maybe where they're making perfume. And then I think, oh, I love that hairstyle that woman has. That is something I'm going to borrow and have, you know, one of the characters wear that hairstyle. So there's all these wonderful little, you know, gems that I find that then help to authenticate the novel and make people feel that they're actually there in that time period.
So will we get to see these authentic visuals starting with the Henna Artist film?
You know, I feel like I have sold my option to the best production team. And I really believe that, you know, Frida Pinto is going to be not only playing Lakshmi, but she's going to be also an executive producer. And she wants to do that so that she can bring as much authenticity to the South Asian storytelling as possible. Because she is, of course, from South Asia. So she and I have had a couple of chats about how she's very involved in making sure that the director is going to be from Asia. The cinematographer is going to be from Asia. So these people will be very familiar with how to authenticate both of these novels visually.
I love that. That will be really great. Well, my final question is, if you were to pick something from these books, or even as standalones, or from the trilogy as you complete it as a whole, what is it that you would really like your readers to take home with them? What is the final message that you want them to walk away with these novels?
Two things, actually. The first is that women are formidable. Women are very strong, that women are multitaskers to the nth degree, and that they deserve a lot more respect and recognition for everything they have contributed to society and to life than they currently get, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
absolutely. And the second thing is that, you know, I want people to realize that South Asia, and when I say South Asia, I mean India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Sri Lanka, mm-hmm. we are more than our stereotypes. So we are more than the art of henna. We are more than the dot on the forehead. We are more than arranged marriages. We are people, just like your people. We have different classes of socioeconomic groups. We have people who go to work, people who raise families, people who farm. You know, we all the same people that you have, we have too. And so I would love for everybody to be able to look at any country in South Asia and go, oh, these people are just, you know, they have the same kind of desires and needs that I do. I shouldn't just know that, you know, this one idea that I had about South Asians, like Apu from The Simpsons, mm-hmm. that's not the only story right. of South Asia.
Right. And I love that. I love how that's coming forth in Own Voices literature as more cultures and more people are being represented more accurately, because we have wonderful authors who are telling a very accurate and a complete story with all of those little aspects in. I'm loving Own Voices literature right now. So that's really fantastic.
Thank you, Emily. Yeah. So am I. I have always loved literature that takes place in other cultures, that is from a different perspective, because I learn so much about other people, and I learn about their food, which, and you know, my books are filled with food because I love Indian food. Yeah. But you learn about food, you learn about the language, you know, a few words here and there are always good to know. And then you kind of also learn about their views about family, their mm-hmm. views about ambition, their views about work. And I love all of that.
Because I do think it's easier to maintain the stereotype than it is to learn something new if we don't have the accurate representation.
Very well put. So well put. And you know, one of the reasons that I had Malik be Muslim in these stories, and then Lakshmi is Hindu, and they work so well together mm-hmm. as a unit, is because I think it's so important for us all to realize that oftentimes what we see portrayed in the media is not the reality of a country or a climate. What's happening in India today is that you still see Muslims and Hindus working together. You still see them owning businesses together. You still see them, you know, enjoying festivals together. And it's important to realize that we are not all always at conflict.
Definitely. I love that. Well, before we leave, how can our listeners connect with you online? Where are you most visible? I know you're active on Instagram and I love it.
I love Instagram. I never thought I would like social media as much, but I love, love, love Instagram. So you can always find me at The Alka Joshi. You can always go online to my website, alkajoshi.com. I am so lucky, Emily, that I have one of the shorter Indian names.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you so much again for spending some time with me today. I'm really going to look forward to Radha's story coming out in a couple of years, and I'll wish you the best on all of your research and your writing. And thank you again for joining me.
Thank you so much, Emily. I really appreciate it.
And thank you to our listeners for joining us on this episode of Lovely Books. If you liked what you heard today, please remember to comment, like, subscribe, leave a review, leave a rating, tell your friends and family about Lovely Books. I hope you have a fantastic couple of weeks reading, and we'll join you again soon as we highlight another lovely book.